Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Want to get more specific now.
Taylor, I asked Miranda and John if it would be all right of all the authors of this volume to invite you on, not only because you're familiar with Mormon Matters and our listeners already love you and appreciate your good brain and stuff like that, but it's because I think your section, your piece deals with the place in history that we've invested the most as Latter-day Saints. And it has everything to do with things like the fifth and sixth articles of faith, you know, that primitive church, and we're just like it, you know, here in Mormonism. And there were these callings and there was these spiritual gifts and everything that was active then, we've got active now. And so we're into this big parallel, you know, our church, ancient church, and we've invested so much into that I think when, you know, the apostasy narrative is challenged, it's complicated and stuff like that, it's your section that you know is, you know, we need to spend the most time with. So if you're all right, kind of take us carefully through, describe however you would like what you think maybe you even grew up with. Maybe you can just talk from your own personal perspective. I grew up with a vision of the early church as this. My scholarship has led me to this. and start to articulate some of the complexities about the hybridity and all that kind of stuff that you know basically challenges the naive assumptions. And then, you know, the rest of us will just kind of jump in and ask you questions as you go along. But would you mind just basically taking us through your essay and the current state of scholarship about early Christianity?
Yeah, I studied religion as an undergraduate and then in graduate school in exclusively non-Mormon contexts. I didn't ever really have Mormon teachers or anything like that. And sort of learned as much as I could from reading the books that were being published in the 90s and early 2000s when I was a student. And those had a profound impact on me early in my studies. But the further I got into my own research, I started to feel a little dislocated from some of the work that I had been reading from Mormon scholars of that generation as not really matching up with the picture of early Christianity that I was being trained in graduate school especially. And so I was really excited to be invited to be a part of this volume because it gave me an occasion to really kind of think critically and in a disciplined way about these issues that had been so much on my mind, but I hadn't really given direct attention to. Now, definitely the number one question that I was always asked when I mentioned that I was studying early Christianity was, what date did the apostasy happen? You know, so this was very much a part of the way that many Mormons thought about early Christianity that I was talking to as well.
With the breath of the last apostle.
Yeah.
You know, right.
When did so-and-so die and when? So it was you know, that narrative is something that is pervasive and at least was among the other graduate students that I was talking to in other disciplines and so on, and people I was having conversations with, family members and so on. But the interesting thing was, and I was able to kind of piece this together later, was that model of the originally pure church, which later falls away into apostasy, the authority is lost, the pure teachings are lost, and so on.
Those darn Greeks got in there and put their philosophy mingled with scripture.
Exactly. We took this narrative that it was Greek philosophy or Greek thought that corrupted Christianity. And in a way, there was a kind of anti-intellectual aspect to all of that. The Greeks sort of represented intellectual thought and that could corrupt the pure, spiritual, simple teachings of the gospel and so on. So, but one of the things that I started to notice was that that narrative for early Christianity, which had been dominant for much of the 19th and early 20th centuries in German, British, and American scholarship, began to be turned on its head in the early 20th, mid-20th, and late 20th century especially. And instead of there being an originally pure early church, we were instead seeing a radically diverse early church, which instead of dissolving into apostasy and plurality, was actually becoming increasingly uniform, especially through the exercise of the authority of the state after Constantine in the early 300s. And so it was almost the mirror image of the narrative that I had been led to believe and was kind of reading about early on, that there was an original plurality that became increasingly singular, and there was a lot of anxiety about that diversity of early Christianity in those early days, and a lot of worry about stamping out that diverse thought that had been representative of really the first and especially the second centuries. So that's kind of where I came to it, and to start to think about, well, how does this new narrative that scholars are telling that they believe and I believe better represents the material that we have from the first 2-3 centuries of early Christianity, how does that match on, or how can that match on to our apostasy narrative? So my essay in some ways tries to tackle that problem.
Terrific. Yes. So do you want to take us through the material, or Miranda, is there anything that you would say that his essay does that he hadn't at least mentioned there?
Well, I think Taylor really asks us to think about why, as you said, why we're so invested in having an early church that's pure. I mean, you know, what are the implications behind using that term pure to describe the early church or the Christ church?
Yeah, pure and then corrupt. And Taylor, it was interesting. One of just the little, you know, you probably only spent a few sentences on it, but you talked about how any purity narrative often will feed into racism and things like that too. So that was a great insight. Just kind of, I don't know, that was, certainly wasn't a major focus, but it was terrific.
Well, there's really no, I mean, there's an absolute, well, what's the right way of saying it? There's no coincidence, I guess, that 19th century German scholars developing these notions of purity of the early church and purity of certain really racialized depictions of Jews, Greeks, and so on are the precursors to, you know, and really, I shouldn't say quite the precursors, but coming out of certain racist ideologies in the 19th century that lead, of course, into the racist ideologies of the 20th century in Germany as well. So a lot of people have made this connection and are sort of thinking about critically the kinds of ethnic and racial language that so much of what was going on in the way that Christianity and all religions were being described and put into hierarchies and so on in this sort of beginnings of scholarly assessment of this period.
Yeah. Cool. Well, let me guide you, Taylor, a little bit, okay? So I'll just give you some assumptions that I think a lot of Latter-day Saints have, and a lot of Christians have, too. So, and then you can kind of just react with the scholarship that's, you know, most of the stuff I think is in your essay. So the idea that here's Jesus, and he, you know, starts his ministry. The first thing he does is he calls 12 guys. The importance of 12 guys, that everyone recognized that this is sort of like Jesus is the preacher, and these 12 apostles as a group are, you know, they're leader type groups. And so we of course think that now in Mormonism. How does that track with the early record?
Well, it gets complicated really quick because the two earliest accounts that we have refer to there being 12. That's the Gospel of Mark and the epistles of Paul, especially Galatians and 1 Corinthians. But they don't refer to these 12 as apostles. It's not until later that we start to get the term apostle being used to describe these 12. And so it seems to, and in fact, Paul's use of the apostle is explicitly not to refer to these 12 as apostles. He refers to a whole set of other people who are not part of the 12 as apostles. So it, it seems to be a kind of later innovation, primarily of Luke, it seems, it appears at least, to identify these 12 as apostles and only these 12 as apostles. And many of the other texts that we have from early Christianity, both in the canon and not in the canon, refer to apostles as a very diverse set of people. And even if we were to...
Including a woman, say, Junia.
A really crucial figure here, as it has become in contemporary debates over women's ordination in various denominations, including ours. So we're immediately confronted with a complication to that narrative of there being originally 12 apostles. Even the lists of names that we have from the various gospels of who those 12 apostles are, none of them actually match up. They're all a little bit different. So there doesn't even seem to be agreement on who those 12 were. So yeah, that's one of the first kind of historical problems that we run into in that narrative, is that there seem to have been 12, or at least at some point there was a tradition of there having been 12, but nobody seems to agree who they were. And whether or not they were apostles was also a little bit up in the air.
Right. And whoever the 12 were, whether they're apostles or not, most writers wouldn't have considered Paul as one of the 12, and yet we all give him the status of being an apostle.
Exactly. Paul, he very much insists on his status as an apostle. It's a status that he clearly considers to be important. He values the title of apostle. But he also explicitly says it was not something that he was ordained to. He was called directly by God. And so this kind of apparatus around church structure and hierarchy and human beings ordaining other people doesn't seem to be a part of his understanding of what that term means either.
Right. And Miranda, while I got you here, just quick, the title of the book, Standing Apart, tie that to the word apostle for us real quick.
Oh, well, it actually has to do with the word apostasy rather than apostle.
That's right. You're right. One who's sent out versus one standing apart. You're right.
Yeah.
But apo means apart,
away
or
from.
Away from, yeah.
And then stasia means standing. So standing away from, standing apart from. That's, yeah, we did kind of a play on words on the etymology of the word apostasy.
That's great. But then apostle, what's the etymology of apostle? It's one who is sent away to preach, right? Isn't that it, Taylor?
Yeah, that seems to be the best explanation of what it means, that one who is sent out. It acquires a kind of increasingly technical meaning in as I say, some of the Gospels that it doesn't necessarily have in the other texts, where it's often synonymous with a teacher, a missionary. Prophets and apostles are often linked together in some of the other texts that we have describing apostles. So its exact meaning is a little bit contested, and that's part of what I'm trying to suggest and point to there as well, is that even in early Christianity, there isn't a singular meaning of what exactly an apostle is. And we actually see that exact same process, well, not necessarily the exact same thing, but a very similar process developing in early Mormonism as well.
Yeah, DNC.
We see a development of what that term means and who gets called it and why they get called it and what it means when they're called it is something which is very much in flux in early Mormonism. And I see this, as a point of similarity between early Christianity and Mormonism, and also recognizing that these things change, evolve, develop with time, with further revelation, and so on, is a part of the story of the term apostle as well.
Nice. Okay, so with no body of 12 that are leading the church after Jesus, then this clear, Jesus has signaled this, the Mormon narrative of upon the death of the last apostle, we basically... Like I was teasing a little bit earlier, that marks the beginning of the true apostasy, because somehow or other, with priesthood and this office, we're free from the influence of those Greeks and all the, you know, all the things that are in the air. Somehow there's a special channel that comes with the apostolic calling. So anything that at all supports that in early documents.
Well, yeah, you say exactly. You bring in another term here, which is really crucial, which is priesthood. And that's another aspect of the way that people have thought about what the apostle sort of embodies, is both the purity of the teachings of Jesus as a kind of direct link, a connection to that original moment of Jesus's teachings, and also, as you say, the authority or the priesthood. So one of the other aspects about thinking about priesthood in the early church is that's also not really a term that shows up so much for thinking about offices or authority in early Christianity. Most early Christians, if you said to them, talked about the priesthood, they would think of the Jewish priesthood or perhaps the priesthood of a particular pagan temple or something like that, but didn't necessarily think of themselves as priests. We don't see that really developing in the way that we would talk about it today until the 3rd century, and especially in the 4th century, where we start to get sacerdotal language to talk about Christian bishops, Christian presbyters, and so on. So that's also a kind of later development in some respects.
Okay. And so did Jesus ever lay his hands upon anybody's head and designate them or set them apart for something that would in any indication whatsoever kind of say, I am setting up a church that should continue after I'm gone? In other words, you know, or was Jesus more just, I'm preaching, I'm changing hearts, I'm starting a movement, people are seeing themselves in a new way? Was he making plans for after he was gone in terms of, you know, a structure?
Well, I wasn't there, so I can't say
right. Okay.
One way or the other, right? What we have are the records of people, in some cases, one generation in the case of Paul, in most cases, 2 to 3 generations after, that are telling these stories, right? So I don't know. I'm not confident enough to say what our texts will allow us to say with respect to what Jesus actually did. But what we do see developing in over the course of those decades after Jesus' death is a greater attention to structure and authority that are not present in the earliest texts.
Okay.
So that seems to give us some good hints that the question of structure and authority is something that we see developing primarily, you know, really at its height in the 4th century, but developing in various ways in different regions and different locales, unevenly, I guess we could say, throughout the first few centuries.
And I'm sure that's typical for every tradition, that once the founder is gone, this stuff starts to take over for everybody, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, to draw another parallel to early Mormonism, very much the structures that we have in early Mormonism, especially after Joseph's death, that's the source of the succession crisis, is these various institutions that Joseph has set up. And a big debate ensues about, well, which one is the one and where do we go next? So we have competing authorities existing from the beginnings of Mormonism as well. And we see a similar, not identical, but a similar phenomenon of competing authorities in early Christianity too.
Good. And you, in fact, started your essay almost with that whole idea that right from the beginning, look at the earliest text, which is Paul's epistles. Everything he's saying is, you know, hey, you guys are starting to listen to other people and give you a brand of Christianity, or, you know, he's not naming it Christianity, but a brand of teaching in the gospel that's taking you astray from my pure, the way that I taught you when I visited you the first time kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, and the way that many Mormons have understood that story has been, well, see, the apostasy is already starting, right?
Satan is at work, baby.
Right. But I want to ask the question, well, what does the fact of early Christian diversity, what story does that tell us? Does it only tell us the apostasy story? And it's really complicated to start to say that the apostasy already exists in the time of Paul, I think. But maybe it tells us a different story instead, not about the original purity, which is lost, but the original diversity. And that's the way that most scholars are understanding it as well. If anything, Paul is the innovator here, not the people that he's railing against in Galatians, for instance.
Cool. Before we get too far away from it, Jesus, whether he started a church, there's always this, fascinating little 40-day ministry of Jesus Christ where he and the disciples were doing their own thing. Is there anything in that kind of material, again, there's nothing really solid in the scriptures, but is there anything in that material that would, sort of feed the narrative of he really spent a lot of times organizing a church?
This is a really interesting question. It's not one that I address directly in the article, but from what I know about it and what I can tell from my own research on this is that this the importance of this 40-day ministry sort of appears for the first time in Mormon thought as a kind of crucial moment in a 1966 article by Hugh Nibley, so almost 50 years ago.
So nobody in the early church was thinking about this. Of course, they weren't really questioning the narrative either.
Well, in terms of, you mean the early Mormon church?
Yeah.
Not that I could tell. I've kind of looked over a lot of the older apostasy materials from, Talmage and so on, and I don't really see much discussion of it. I may have missed something, but it's really Nibley that kind of popularizes this idea, and he's drawing on some recent discoveries of some new manuscripts that had appeared in from early Christianity that we call the Nag Hammadi libraries. It's a kind of similar story to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in Israel. And what he sees in these texts are a set of post-resurrection appearances of Jesus, where Jesus is often depicted as preaching esoteric knowledge.
Right. That's why all the Gnostics love all this back in the early days.
Exactly. And Nibley is sort of one of the first people who's looking at these texts. There are a lot of other scholars who are first kind of starting to make sense of these. And he fits them into this 40-day ministry narrative. It's not one that's really accepted today as a kind of general explanation for these post-resurrection appearances. But needless to say that it's one of those kind of gaps in the text of the book of Acts itself, which is where we get the only reference to this post-resurrection 40-day ministry of Jesus. And it tells us almost nothing about what was happening there. So it's also a kind of fruitful place where people can start to fill in
right
what they thought Jesus taught.
Right. So even though he's teaching the esoteric stuff according to Nag Hammadi, there's nothing in there like after now that I'm dead, you guys gotta have an organization to move the work forward.
The kind of questions of church hierarchy and so on are really not coming up in those texts so much. It's a lot of stuff about how to ascend through the different realms of heaven and things along those lines. One small exception might be the Gospel of Mary, which is the only one of those texts which is attributed to a woman and is about Mary Magdalene, where there is some discussion about Mary's status as a woman, whether or not that qualifies her to teach. But for the most part, the questions of church order and those kinds of things are not really present in even those apocryphal texts about what Jesus taught in the resurrected state.
Sweet. Thanks. So early Christianity, much more diverse, a bunch of people, not a whole lot of structures and things like that. What, you use the word hybridity. Do you want to go and introduce that?
Sure. So one of the major, I think, philosophical differences for thinking about history that we can see from the early 20th century when the apostasy is developing and contemporary, the way that history is practiced by contemporary historians, is that we don't believe anymore in these kinds of moments of purity, of original uniqueness, that were so much of what we've kind of inherited and informed the apostasy narrative. And one of the terms that I suggest kind of captures this new way of thinking about historical moments is hybridity. And what that means is that instead of there being a kind of singular essence, a singular truth, a singular core aspect of a particular moment, that instead what we see are plural possibilities. We see embeddedness within multiple different narratives, multiple different perspectives, and that oftentimes these are in competition with one another as well. And so I guess I'm suggesting that thinking, using hybridity to think about early Christianity can also help us think about Mormonism as well, as not something which is absolutely pure, absolutely unique, has no connection to its own historical context, but instead that we always already exist in these complicated braided networks of meaning. And that's a point not of crisis or of anxiety or even nihilism, as some people want to see it, if there's no absolute core essential truth or meaning to any particular thing, but instead points to these new possibilities of multiple plural non-essentialist ways of living and thinking. It's sort of a philosophical point that I'm making, but I'm trying to draw on the way that historians are thinking about the past in different ways than we used to think about them. So if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I love it. And I'm just, my debate within my own head is, when you kind of offer some positive framings for the future, you introduce Joseph Smith as having a critique of the early apostles or the early church, but it wasn't so much that there was this diversity, that there was this hybridity, that there was all this kind of stuff here, but that they didn't have compassion for each other. They didn't offer forgiveness. They just handled the diversity, which was a good thing, poorly. Something like that. Is that, I probably botched your point, but
no, I think that's right on. I think that at least some of the ways, not the only ways, but some of the ways that Joseph Smith is talking about early Christianity are about nurturing the plurality, the diversity that exists within it. And he suggests that what happened, what brought down early Christianity in his view, is not that there was diversity, but that people weren't generous with one another, that people weren't open to multiple perspectives. So he has a couple of quotes. I can maybe read one of them that's here. I never thought it was right to call up a man and try him because he erred in doctrine. It looks too much like Methodism and not like Latter-day Saintism. Methodists have creeds which a man must believe or be kicked out of their church. I want the liberty of believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. And this idea of sort of a more robust inclusion of a diverse perspectives seems to be one of the ways that Joseph Smith thought about what made good Christianity and what made bad Christianity. And he seemed to be more open to a diverse, again, not always, not universally. This isn't the only way. Again, I'm a hybrid thinker, I guess, right?
That nice.
We have multiple perspectives, right? But one of the ways that I think that we could draw on fruitfully is Joseph Smith's openness to diversity.
Yes, I love that. That was terrific. Good. Another one of your three areas where you said is comparative religion as a, you know, what we can learn from the act of comparison and how that can open things up in a nice way for us. Do you want to go into that?
Sure. I guess I grew to despair a little bit by some of the apologetic approaches that we have taken as a community to early Christianity that struck me as really problematic historically. So we would go in kind of mining for these nuggets of finding, okay, here's where baptism for the dead was, or here's where temple rites were, or things like that.
Yep.
And in my own research, my own investigation became less and less convinced by some of the ways that we were talking about those kinds of things. So not that there aren't any parallels or there aren't some striking moments of continuity between Mormonism and early Christianity, but that the ways that we have talked about that in kind of this apologetic mode of saying, aha, how could Joseph have known that or something like that, just struck me as inadequate to both Mormonism and early Christianity. So I suggest that comparative religion may offer some better ways of thinking about the meaning of there being connections between Mormonism and early Christianity. This isn't to deny that there are connections, but that we be careful about how we go about talking about what those are, and that we think about the implications for broader questions in terms of what is religion, what is the problem that Mormonism and early Christianity are addressing or solving through these rituals, through these similar doctrines, and so on. So I guess I just think that there are some more productive ways than the "aha, how could Joseph have known that" kind of approach that really had, I think, has too much dominated the way that we talk about the connections between Mormonism and early Christianity.
Yeah, that was a fun section. I enjoyed that one a lot. Hermeneutics. You were talking about, employing a new hermeneutic, and explain that term to people as you pulled out your third area here.
Sure. So hermeneutics is the philosophy of interpretation, I guess. And here, I guess I'm suggesting that I don't want to just be a dry historian that kind of accounts for the past, but that I am interested in what does the past mean for the present, and thinking about kind of, as one of the great hermeneutical scholars talks about it, this sort of horizon where the past and the present meet. And that's a part of how we tell history and what history means and why we do history. And I don't want to give up on that, but also want to think about ways that are a little bit more sophisticated than, again, the ones that have come before. And I try and draw on the legacy that we have in the apostasy narrative of thinking about the past and telling our own story. And so by no means do I want to give up on that project entirely, but want to think and continue the tradition that the apostasy narrative and so many other Christians have done before us of thinking about how is the early Christian story relevant to, and how can it inform, what lessons can it teach us? And I suggest, as I kind of already pointed to before, that there are some ethical problems that we can see in early Christianity that hopefully we can learn from, including the emphasis on heresy as a point of exclusion from the community, things along those lines that historians of early Christianity really see, as one put it, debate and dissension are completely eliminated on certain questions at particular moments in early Christianity, where it's very dangerous to raise certain kinds of questions. And I think that we can look at that and say that's maybe not something that we want to replicate in the contemporary.
though we're actively doing it, yeah, so it's good to point out that how problematic that was then, and maybe make that leap. And then the other thing, there was something in there about the enforcing of authority instead of... I should have taken a better note on that one, and I'm not looking at the text. Wasn't there something that's the other place where communities break down?
Yeah, and it seems that we have, I already mentioned that one quote from Joseph Smith where he seems to be suspicious of power and authority. And there are other things like DNC 121, which try to really raise the question of power as a problem. And this also, I think, reflects a lot of the ways that contemporary scholars are thinking about early Christianity, analyzing the dynamics of power. It is very much a way that especially late 20th century scholars think about approaching certain kinds of social questions, paying attention to the way that certain phenomena develop in terms of analyzing power. And there's built into Mormonism a kind of suspicion of power that I think can help us, that we can draw out some of that suspicion of power that our religious tradition has, that I think very much aligns with some of the contemporary scholarly trends for thinking about and being critical of power too.
Yeah, yeah. And I did just find a line in that last, the summary paragraph of your piece that I wanted to raise too, and that's, how the problem is how differences came to matter in disharmonious ways, how unity was sought at the expense of community. And I think when you talk about there's the ethical issues that are at stake here, and we talked a little bit earlier about being willing to forgive others and be willing to have a diversity of opinions and stuff around us, that's what we're talking about with community and the richness of it, and that there is sort of a static sterility towards unity that you know, it may sound good in the abstract, but we would all pretty much consider it fairly shallow if we were to truly have, you know, ideological unity, if nothing else.
Absolutely. And this is not to say that there are not limits on how far a community can stretch and so on. I'm not sure what those limits are, and I'm glad I don't have to decide those kinds of questions. But yeah. But thinking not about where those limits are, in some ways that seems to be the wrong kind of question. It's about how should we ethically engage with those who are different from us, who think differently from us. I think what one of the things that Joseph Smith is calling us to do when he chastises, I think it's in DNC 62, the early church for not forgiving one another. And he's not as concerned with where the boundary is, but with how the boundary is policed, I guess, in terms of the right kinds of virtues that we bring to our conversations with those with whom we disagree.
Yeah. And I love that that came out of you thinking about the early church and how that just, what you just said is like the key issues of today, at least in a lot of the circles that this podcast kind of circulates among. So, dude, thank you. Loved your essay, man. And loved having you back on the show, too. Thanks.
It was a real pleasure. Thanks so much, Dan. I hope that the book is widely read, because I think it's a real achievement for Miranda and John to have put this together. So thanks for featuring it.
You bet. Miranda, before we drop off of Taylor, the conversation specifically about Taylor's essay, is there anything else that occurs to you to offer about that, or something that it caused you to reflect on?
I guess I wanted to point out that I think we can look at maybe the Puritans as an example of a religious community that gets so caught up in trying to reproduce what they imagine to be primitive Christianity, that they kind of, their community ends up imploding on itself. Because as Taylor was saying, when you get obsessed with trying to maintain purity, that you start building lots of boundaries against people that you find dangerous or heretical or different. And that just creates a lot of social problems and communal problems. And so I talked a little bit about that at the end of my chapter, because I think that is I think Mormons like have that tendency to want to draw on that, our Puritan heritage and do okay. that. And so like Taylor, I think I have been disturbed with some of the ways that we articulate anachronistic parallels, perhaps with the early church, just because I think we're not as self-conscious about sometimes the implications of doing that. And so I really appreciate Taylor for drawing out the ethical implications of telling or of wanting to tell a narrative of purity and saying, hey, maybe we should think about some other options. I'm really glad that we were able to know that the book has his essay in it.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the book, guys. It really is fantastic. And anybody who's sat through this last hour listening to this, I got to think that you've already ordered while you were listening. So congratulations on that. Let's head towards a wrap up here. You know, say where we're at. We and Mormonism today, and so many people who are coming to faith crisis, faith transition, these moments of, you know, pulling apart and putting back together, you know, this stuff that you've covered here today is a shock to them. It's like, what do you mean? This isn't a clean narrative. This isn't an innocent narrative. You guys have, all this scholarship has, like, it comes and it complicates that, and yet each one of you still are Mormons. Everyone who writes in this article, in this book, are still Mormons. And so what's at stake here? Should faith be at stake in the fact that these narratives are now far more complicated than what it is? And what's your best reasons for saying that this does not mean that Mormonism is built upon a shaky foundation, just the fact that we have this, you know, naive apostasy restoration narrative? John, do you want to try that one first?
Well, I think that one of the things we try to do, and this comes out a little bit in the introduction, is that, you know, we have, this was written in conjunction with sort of the Mormon moment. I mean, it wasn't written in reaction to that necessarily, but it was, it happened to coincide in time. Greater attention is being paid to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints than has ever been paid before, partly due to people like Mitt Romney, things like the Salt Lake Olympics, and there may be other examples that we could trot out there. And so this is a timely exploration, because we are coming into more and more contact with peoples of other faiths, peoples of other traditions. And I think we have to ask ourselves, is this traditional apostasy narrative something that is absolutely fundamental to our faith? Meaning the narrative that was formulated by Talmadge, Roberts, Smith, and others, is this something foundational to our faith, or are there potentially other options here? And, I mean, if Mormonism were really simple, I mean, if it was a straightforward, you know, here's the list of things that Mormons should believe, and I guess we have the 13 Articles of Faith, but it does go beyond that, right? If Mormonism were really simple and straightforward and did not have a complicated history at all, then perhaps this would present a sort of crisis of faith to some people. But Mormonism, like other religions that have a now fairly long history, though not long in comparison to many other faiths, right, and some distinct periods within it, and sort of a history of its own development, both in terms of doctrine and culture and political and social organization. If all of that were simple and straightforward, then yeah, this might be foundation shaking. But we have these options, and each one of us as Mormons have to kind of work out our own salvation, and ultimately our relationship with God is on an individual basis. With those options, and we've suggested a number of options, and I think that the authors of this book probably would disagree on some points, most likely. I know that from having conversations with some of the people who wrote for the book. That each of us, you know, can take a view of apostasy and restoration out of this and do something productive with it and be self-reflective and form our own identity as a Mormon.
I'll build on that. That I think that there's something that this book captures in terms of the contemporary moment of Mormonism and in particular Mormon intellectual life right now, of really the richness, the creativity, the optimism that I think many Mormon intellectuals have right now. And I know that we are in a moment, as you said, Dan, where many people are experiencing a quote-unquote faith crisis, but there's also a simultaneous kind of retelling of the story of what Mormonism is and can be. And this book participates in that in a way of bringing together really some of the most exciting young minds of Mormonism to tackle this particular issue of the apostasy. And what results is so fascinating and so worth reading, and I really hope that this book can make a long-lasting influence, and I compliment Miranda and John for putting together such a strong collection of people here. But there are two things that I think that really come out of it that we hadn't had before. First is, I think, a reflection on the ethical dimensions of the apostasy narrative. And primarily what we had, as Miranda and John note in their introduction, is a kind of apologetic history here. And what almost surprisingly uniformly we see in the reflections in this essay is a kind of critique of the ethical problems that the way that we have talked about the past, the way that we talk about other religious traditions, have seeped into this apostasy narrative. And right. on the other hand, the other thing that's, I think, really crucial to, again, surprisingly uniform across all of these essays, is this pointing to multiple possibilities, multiple resources within the tradition, not a rejection of Mormonism or Mormonism's narratives about itself, but a finding of a whole set of new ways of thinking about how we relate to other people, of thinking about the past and so on. And both of those kind of struck me as like how much in common all of these essays had.
Yeah, I agree. Every one of them offered something like that you were just talking about. And I thought the ethics emphasis that you brought up was terrific too. Miranda, any thoughts of yours on, like, you know, what's at stake here, you know, personal testimony, like having to reframe this? What makes it exciting for you versus scary or that kind of thing?
Well, I came to the Middle Ages kind of by accident, unexpectedly. I ended up falling in love with Old English poetry when I was an undergraduate at BYU. And so the Old English is the language spoken by the Anglo-Saxons who lived in England from about 500, and then they were invaded by the Normans in 1066. So Beowulf is the most famous poem from that period. Mm-hmm. But so that love led me to study the Middle Ages in graduate school. And I've developed just a really deep appreciation for the medieval religious imagination. And it's been troubling to go to church and then hear all these negative things said about the Middle Ages. And that really, I find painful because, I mean, not that I know medieval people like personally, but I consider them my friends. And so it's hard to, you know, to go to church and just hear these lessons about how awful and dark and spiritually, you know, misguided.
Benighted. People, how benighted they all
benighted,
are.
Benighted, yeah, that the Middle Ages were. And so I think that's part of the reason why I wanted to take the opportunity to do this project is just wanting to share how much we can learn from the past and how much, because I've learned a tremendous amount from studying medieval Christianity. It's increased my faith. It's given me new ways of envisioning my relationship with God, envisioning my relationship with the scriptures. And it's really enriched my life in profound ways. And so I don't know that our project, it was never motivated by a desire to critique or to deconstruct the church, the LDS church in any way. I think really we all are coming from our professional experiences with different historical periods and different religious cultures. And we wanted to share that with people, and we wanted to share the richness and the beauty that we find in these periods and these cultures. And we wanted to say, look, wouldn't it be great if we could tell some stories, if we could tell our own story in ways that really celebrate our relationship with the riches and the beauty of the past and of our fellow neighbors as we all are, we're all part of God's family, and God loves all of his children. And as John was saying, I do truly believe that no matter what time period that God is working to help his children understand who he is, and he provides opportunities for his children to return with him, and we call that salvation. And even though different communities and different traditions have different have developed different philosophies of how that happens. I think fundamentally we're united in our humanity as yeah. being God's children. And so I think that's really the message of this book, is not to shake people's faith, but to really affirm God's love for his children. And so that's why we picked the passages from the Doctrine and Covenants at the beginning of the book, where it talks about turning our hearts to our fathers, and that being a really profound responsibility of members of the church today. And I think for all of God's family, we need to not exclude each other. We need to love each other. And I think that's really the message of the book, is that love, that overwhelming love.
I agree with you. That is the message of the book, and that is the beauty of it, because all of them are hopeful, and all of them don't really concentrate on what I think is that initial shock that so many folks who, you know, are in these crises and these transition are like, oh, here's another thing that's all complicated now. Here's another, easy, clean narrative that bites the dust. And there's that disappointment there. But if we can push past the disappointment, the stuff that you just nailed down for us is so much richer, so much better than, oh, gee, we have to rethink ourselves, because now we get to include everybody in a much more loving, compassionate framing. So I thought you nailed it there. That was wonderful. Thank you. Thank all of you for being on the podcast. We really had a good time here today. I'm excited for your book. I want to congratulate you guys. It's Oxford Press. I'm assuming it's available through Amazon and everything as well?
It's on Amazon.
Okay.
Yep. Well,
they're electronically available too now. So.
Oh, good, good. So I'll just put a link to Amazon, and if people want to buy it through that, a little bit of percentage, slight percentage, goes to Mormon Matters from clicking through from my link. So if anybody wants to support the podcast by buying the book that way, please click from the blog, mormonmatters.org. And, of course, while you're at the website, you can click the donate button or the subscribe button, and help the podcast out, help me out. It's a big part of what I do for a living, and your support is just really, really welcomed, and I'm just grateful for everything that you do. Thanks. John and Miranda and Taylor, thank you for being on the podcast. You guys have been amazing guides.
Well, thank you, Dan.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
And joy.